It's election season, and we're going to look at Florida House District 96 today, a race between incumbent Kristen Jacobs and her opponent, Saima Farooqui. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. District 96 includes Parkland. We'll hear from both candidates this week. Today, we're going to hear from Farooqui. If she wins, she's going to be the first Muslim American in the state house in Tallahassee. Plus, we're going to meet Victoria Burgess. She's a Pompano Beach fire inspector. She paddleboarded from Havana to Key West in just under 28 hours.
Moment, I didn't have any emotional breakdown or anything like that. I was just happy to be there, and it was kind of like a bit of a blur.
She shares her experience living on her paddleboard through all sorts of seas. And finally, we meet a barber who started helping underprivileged kids with free haircuts if they got good grades. That's led to the creation of the Buzz Box. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello, and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. There's a surge of female candidates running for state and federal offices across the country this year. Many have been inspired by the Trump presidency and a desire to bring more female representation into government. Among those is Saima Farooqui, running for District 96 in Broward County. The district encompasses Parkland, Coconut Creek, Margate, Pompano Beach, and Coral Springs. If Saima is elected, she would become the first Muslim ever to be elected in the Florida State House. As a longtime Coconut Creek resident and a Geek Squad employee, she wants to bring the concerns of her constituents to Tallahassee from a unique perspective. She's facing a tough uphill battle against incumbent Kristen Jacobs. She has a sizable lead in fundraising and in polling data. Now, we spoke with Farooqui last week about her desire to run for office and the primary issues in her campaign.
First of all, thank you very much for having me and giving me this opportunity of speaking to my listeners and speak about that, what my platform is and why I'm running. As a member of the community and living in my district for 13 years, I have felt that I have grasped the issues that the community is facing, and the current political climate change is basically brings an important need for all Americans to have representation in the government.
You know, I wondered, what was the moment, that actual moment when you decided this is what you want to do? Where were you at the time? What was it that launched the idea?
In February, when I heard this accident or this tragedy in Parkland at school, when that happened, that actually just changed everything. And that has actually motivated me to run for the office and do something, because I just want to make my community, my children, safe. So that was the moment that has changed everything in February. And then I have looked into running, and from February to April, that I was just trying to see that what can I do and how I can bring the change.
So I had read when you started canvassing, you had to go door to door and introduce yourself to people and let them know, but you had to gain signatures. And so I was just curious, like, what was that experience like? I mean, you're going around telling people, I'm running for your district. Oh, and by the way, I'm Muslim. But I mean, what was the experience like?
I mean, I don't really have to tell that I'm Muslim, because I am very visible in my beliefs, and I wear this headscarf. So, but that was not really an issue for people to accept me at their doors. Of course, there were a few interactions, they really didn't go well, but for most part, it was very welcoming. And when I introduced as a common person, not a politician, that I would be running for the office, people were very happy to see someone from them, like someone who's living in the community and visibly, and they see me around. So they were very happy to see me. And it was very welcoming.
And I mean, every now and then, did you run into anybody who had a problem with that? That have a problem with you?
Yes, of course. Like, not a problem with me, specifically, but of course, some people don't really welcome because maybe for the lack of knowledge, but they have probably never met a Muslim. But whatever they see on the media and they read in newspapers, probably that might have just put them in a perception that maybe someone who wears hijab or look different might not be a good fit for this position. But I was able to talk to them, and some people really turned around, and they were very happy. And at the end, they actually signed my petition.
And yeah, so you get to talk to people. Did you feel like you educated some people or maybe changed their mind?
Yes, I was able to talk to people and then really change their minds. And one interaction I still remember, and it was at the parking in Publix, where he asked me why he should be signing that petition and what I would be doing for the community. And he asked me questions about healthcare and the gun safety and, of course, Second Amendment and all that. And at the end, like, it was a 15, 20 minutes conversation. And at the end, he said, okay, you sold yourself, and okay, here is it. And then he signed my petition. And he was a Republican, because the person who signed my petition, I explained to him, like, it does not have to be with a party affiliation. Anyone can sign who is a registered voter in the district. So at the end, he was able, he signed my petition, basically. So I was able to talk to him and change his perception.
There are, my understanding, there are no Republicans running in this district.
No, they're not. No.
Let's talk about the platform. Let's talk about the issues that are most important to you. I mean, when you talk to people, what do you say to them about what you are going to represent them, and what are the biggest issues for you?
Basically, the people living in the district, they're small business owners. Their kids go to the schools, because the schools are pretty good in my district. They are well-graded schools, basically. So they're very concerned about education. School safety is the biggest issue, since Parkland is in my district. So basically, those are the issues, and healthcare, of course, but mostly education is a very important issue for them.
Let's talk about one of the big things. Of course, your district includes Parkland, and this, of course, is the center of school safety and the gun legislation debate going on right now in the state, in the nation. The governor did sign new gun legislation this past session. Do you feel that was a good law?
When it's really bundled into one legislation, like certain clauses, I would not really agree with, but certain things are very effective in sense of like the ban on assault weapon or the age limit increase. So those are the good part of the legislation, but the arming teachers, most people are not really happy about that, or maybe increasing the police or making schools as kind of like police stations. Students are not happy about that, because they want to go to school, not the prisons.
Let me come back real quickly. So part of that law, yes, they increased the age, the age limit for buying a weapon. There was no assault on or no ban on assault weapons. Do you want a ban on assault weapons?
It should be a little bit more I would say a little bit more specifications, because those weapons, they are war-graded weapons. It should not be in the city limits or in hands of citizens. So I would really suggest the ban on assault weapon.
Now, you talked about also schools and making schools safer. If you could do one thing right now to make schools safer, what would that be?
I would increase the security, like metal detectors in the school. Students should have some sort of channels to go and talk to their about their problems. So increasing mental health service counselors would be biggest initiative that I would like to take, because all the problems start when students don't find ways of getting information, and they just go to open sources like internet or somewhere to get that information, and they might not get the right information. So if they would have more counselors available at school, and more teachers, they can engage them for in extracurricular activities. So that might help them to just go and speak about their issues, and that might help. And of course, teachers are not really paid well in Florida public schools. So I would like to see an increase on their pays so they can take more interest in their jobs and they would just feel pride. And then, of course, if they don't have problems on their own plate, then they would be able to perform better at their jobs.
Let me come back to something, though. You said you don't want schools to be like prisons. Mm-hmm. Now, we've heard this from some of the students because of that extra security. Mm-hmm. But having a metal detector could make it feel like, I mean, a little bit more kind of tight. And that's almost a little bit of a, I mean, some students may not like that.
We have to keep them safe somehow. If one or the other way that if we, like when we go to airports, like we do have the, it, even like the hospitals and certain other places have the metal detectors. So it's not really that it would sound like a prison, but it would just bring some sort of security. And of course, students demand the security. So that would be one of the things that I don't think they would mind it.
You're a mother.
I am a mother.
So what do you hear from your kids about, I mean, did you talk to them about how safe or unsafe the school is? What do they tell you?
They are, like, a very concerned. When they were, like, my daughter, when she was in school, they really was they really talk about how bullying is the very major issue at the school. So they sometimes don't feel very safe at school, even though if it's not weapons or guns, that there are other factors. They really make students feel unsafe at schools. And again, that would just come back to the same thing that when we have guidance counselors and other staff available to talk to them, then we can just really handle that situation as well.
You're listening to a previous conversation that we had with Seyma Farooqui. She's one of the candidates running for Florida's District 96. If she's elected, she would be the first female Muslim American in Tallahassee. She's facing Democratic incumbent Kristen Jacobs. Let's return to that conversation. You talk about teachers and that they're underpaid. Now, Miami-Dade and Palm Beach County schools, they're putting a referendum on the ballot for November to raise property taxes to get raises for teachers. If the voters say no, then how do you try and find more money for teachers? Because if they say no, that means they don't want to pay more taxes. Then what?
If it's a very like high increase in taxes, they would not like to increase the taxes in their property tax. But of course, the student safety is the biggest concern for all the parents in Dade, Palm Beach, and Broward as well. So I don't think that it would be a problem, but we have to keep a balance that how much raise it's going to be in the property tax. So if not, then we should find, like I would try to find some other ways of getting money back to the school. And of course, it's funding is available, but we just have to find resources that how we can get just money back.
I mean, do you, if somebody came to you and said, listen, we're going to raise your taxes, it's going to be for teacher pay and school security. You okay with that?
Yes, I would be okay with that. But it depends that how much raise that it's going to be. And the funds would be really allocated towards the safety. And it has to be really allocated for the purpose that they're taking taxes or raising taxes.
All right. If Republicans stay in control of the House and Senate, how do you get anything done as a Democrat? What do you do to reach out and start working with them and then convince them that maybe your ideas are something they should consider?
So I don't think it's a partisan issue because kids are kids. Republicans have kids. Democrats have kids. Even NPAs have kids. Everyone has kids. So the kids' safety and their prosperity is the common concern for all the parents. So I think this is the issue that everyone would be willing to talk about because everyone wants to keep their children safe.
What about other issues? Climate change issues. You know, you talk about businesses and You know, there is a difference between Democrats and Republicans on business legislation that impacts small business owners. I mean, so many other issues, there is a divide. So how do you reach out? If you have, let's say you have a Republican governor as well, you know, come November, how do you reach across to the other side and say, we have to get some stuff done?
It's all about communication, building bridges, and getting your point out and explain. And I'm pretty sure when you explain well, people listen and they really pay attention and they would be on the same page. As I told you, that a recent experience that my interaction with that person to sign the petition. So I'm pretty sure that I would be able to build bridges and getting my point across.
I want to ask you one other thing, too, real quickly, is anti-discrimination laws. This is another issue that's important for you. There are anti-discrimination laws right now on the books in Florida, but what are you proposing? Do we need something more, or is it more about enforcement?
It's more about enforcement, and of course, that should have been revised a little bit because I don't feel that it is... it should be allowable for a business to discriminate against someone who looks different or practices different. Like the recent example of that cake baker, like maker. I think that we should be able to enforce those anti-discrimination laws and practice as well. So everyone feel welcome and
you, I mean, as again, as a Muslim, I'm wondering, like, your personal experiences. You know, what is it, your personal experience that this is an important issue for you, that you want to see changed?
Yes, like when at schools, when kids have been called different names, and there isn't if there's nothing that that was done towards that, or any kind of like measures take towards that. I would really like to see those anti-discrimination laws effective and really enforced. So at schools and workplaces.
We talk about discrimination, on the issue of discrimination. And again, you're a Muslim running for office. There are more Muslims now running nationally for office than we've seen in a long time. But I'm just wondering, how often did you run into people who take issue with that fact? You know, and do you think it's going to be a problem for you?
On most part, people do see a dire need for different communities to be represented in the government. So they are really encouraging other communities to run for the office as well. So I don't see a problem with that, but mostly people are encouraging different communities and especially Muslim community to go ahead and run for the offices.
Now, currently, I mean, you have a day job,
yes.
Like a lot of people. You currently work at the Geek Squad, right?
Yes.
Okay. And you want to focus more on STEM education and training in the area. Where do you see the lack right now, and how would you fix that?
I think in our current education system, I don't think we have enough STEM schools, like magnet schools or STEM programs. So I would like to see that program in public school so students can get those that training that's required to get that kind of jobs. So so I would like to see the magnet program would be introduced in more magnet schools.
You don't have any experience in government though, right?
No, I don't. It's my first time running.
How do you tell people then that you are qualified for this job? What makes you qualified?
My passion, my my passion and my willingness to solve the problems. And there's always a first time for everything. And sometimes when we see that there's no experience, maybe the new brain or new ideas would bring better perspective. And maybe the new person who's running for office or trying to do anything would probably bring new ideas to the table.
So you have the opportunity right now. You're talking to the voters of District 96. You know, they may be asking, why should I vote for you? What do you tell them right now? This is your opportunity. What do you say to them as to what is going to make you the best representative for them?
So One thing I would like to tell my listeners and people who would be voting for me in my district, that I would always be approachable. I don't live in my district part-time. I live there all the time. I work there, and I would be quitting my job after that. So this job would be my only job as a representative. So I would always be approachable. And even on my campaign flyers, I have my personal cell phone number. I don't have a campaign phone number or campaign PO box number. I have my residential address and have my personal cell phone number. So that makes me very approachable to people if they have any issues. They really don't have to go to the office. They can always approach me on my cell phone and my my address.
That's, I mean, you don't see that often. You don't see people letting in, like, this is where I live. This is my home number. Just call me. I mean, that's, you know, how did you feel about, you know, putting yourself out there like that?
That makes me more transparent to people that I'm not a politician and I'm not running for office to have a political career. I'm really running for like for this position to solve the problems. So for me to put out my address or my phone number, it just brings more transparency that I am available, the real person, so you can always reach out to me.
And of course, not having, you know, that staff in the office and all that stuff. I mean, do you have, because one of the things about campaigning is the money. Is that a challenge for you, having the money to be able to run?
Money plays a big role, but it really doesn't play that big. People vote, money doesn't. So if you reach out to people and talk to them, so if I would be sending flyers out, I need money to send flyers out. But if I'm knocking on the doors and meeting with people, that really does not require any money. It just requires time and dedication. So I have knocked on the doors in rain and shine. And when people saw me at their doors in the rain, they just asked me, oh, why you're doing this in the rain? I said, yeah, I could have a cup of coffee and I can enjoy in my backyard. But that really is very important to me to go and reach out to everyone. So they were very happy and they really see that I'm genuine and I'm there. So that really gives me a sense of happiness that, okay.
And again, that is Saima Faruqi running for District 96 against incumbent Kristen Jacobs. She's also the vice president of the Coconut Creek Democratic Club and board member of the Broward Democratic Environmental Caucus. You're going to hear our conversation with Representative Jacobs later this week. Well, still to come, we're going to meet a Pompano Beach woman who might have broken a world record, and she did it when she paddleboarded from Havana to Key West. She's going to tell us all about the journey. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the distance between Havana and Key West is roughly 170 kilometers, or 105 miles. That's the distance that Victoria Burgess paddleboarded recently. She sent that into the Guinness Book of World Records, and she's still waiting to hear back as to whether or not she set a record, because she did that trip in roughly 28 hours, less than 28 hours. Burgess is a fire inspector for the Pompano Beach Fire Department, and the city honored her accomplishment by creating a Victoria Burgess Day. And she spoke with us about why she wanted to do this and details about that journey.
My inspiration to embark on a journey like this, I think more and more so these days, I'm just really trying to push myself physically and mentally while I'm healthy and still can. So that was kind of like the base inspiration of why I chose to do something like this.
What was it like planning this out? I mean, how many months in advance were you planning it? What kind of things were you thinking about?
Logistically, it was a little bit difficult. As far as training goes, I have a decent base training because I race train during the year. So I started 6 months out. I started actually training for this specifically in January. And of course, that was paddle training and land training. And then the logistical aspect was finding the boat captain and making sure we had everything set to be able to launch from Cuba and all that stuff. It took about 6 months.
Did you have to deal with the Cuban government at any point?
I didn't have to deal with the Cuban government at all. The only marina that we could launch from was the Hemingway Yacht Club, and the captain knows the commodore of that yacht club. from doing previous crossings. So he dealt with pulling the permit and our visas and all that stuff. And they were very accommodating. I met them through email beforehand because they wanted to know, you know, what was the reasons I was doing this and things like that and get to know me. And they were awesome. We had a nice meeting when I got there and they were super supportive and it was really cool.
There's a window that you have to do something like this. It's a very, you know, specific time of year that you really want to optimize everything. What is that? And how did that work out for you?
The specific time of year for this channel is, well, when the wind dies down. If it's windy at all, it winds up going against the Gulf Stream and it kind of like stacks the waves up, so it'd almost be impossible. So after we did some research and I looked at previous attempts, anytime after June 20th is usually when the wind dies down. And then you only have a few days window within that. So I hired the boat for 10 days and basically we said whatever day the weather looks best is the day where we're going to leave. I wanted to leave the first day just because, you know, I didn't want to be sitting over there all anxious. And it just worked out that the best day was the first day that we were there or that I was able to leave. So it was kind of perfect.
You're already a competitive paddleboarder, but, you know, I'm just wondering, like, the training that you have to do for a journey like this. How many days a week? What sort of workouts were you doing? What were you doing to physically and mentally prepare?
Yeah, the training was definitely different for this. I do race competitively. They're usually short races, mostly like 8 miles. I've done a couple of longer crossings that were like 33 miles, but this was about 3 or 4 times more than the longest I'd ever done. So I did a lot of research on ultra endurance training and such with bikers and runners because there isn't much for paddlers. And I basically took a lot of their different trainings, which when it comes to ultra distance, it's all over the place. And I tried to like piece something together that would make sense for me. And I know the way my body recovers and feels after workouts. So that's kind of how I planned it, with the longest paddle being 12 hours. I did mostly hour training instead of distance. And then nutritionally, it was the same thing. I had did a lot of ultra endurance nutrition stuff. I'm a certified sports nutritionist, so I have a background in that. And I was able to piece together and I practiced a lot of my eating. And I knew if I could keep myself fed and I didn't have any GI distress, there was a good chance I'd be able to make it and just not get mentally fatigued. And yeah, so that's what I worked on a lot of. I added yoga in there also for meditation purposes and flexibility. And I think that really helped a lot.
At any point during the training, did you ever think, maybe this is too much for me? I don't know if I could do it.
Well, yeah. I mean, when we were on our way over, we took the boat over. It was a sailboat, so it went slow. And it took 22 hours to get there. And actually, that was the first thought I had, because the night we went over, we had a storm and we were sleeping down below and, you know, it's a lot more bumpy down below. So I was laying there thinking to myself, what did I just get myself into? Because we knew there might be similar winds the following few days. So that was my first, what did I do time. And then about 2 hours after dark is when I questioned myself the most. I realized how far or how long I had been paddling, and I realized how much longer I had to go and how much longer it was going to be dark. And I was like, what? Why am I doing this again?
Take us to that first day. You're in Cuba. You launched early in the morning. What was it like? What were you thinking at that moment, the moment you push off and you started this?
Most of my nervousness came before we actually even left for Cuba. So I got a lot of the jitters out of the way. When we went to go say goodbye to the Commodore, there was a lot of media there. And I think it was kind of a little bit like a blur. I mean, I was excited, but, you know, a little bit nervous. And I didn't really know, you know, what exactly when I could leave or if I should just step off now. So they said the time and I was like, all right, well, we're going to go. So I just kind of pushed off and went. And I felt really relaxed. And we had about a mile before we entered the ocean from the marina, so I used that time. It was like the only time I was by myself to just kind of like warm up and relax and try to get my head in gear.
What were the conditions like? Wasn't it like almost right after you left that you were already starting to face you know, some difficult, choppy waters.
Yeah. We had originally had a forecast that was supposed to be 5 to 10 knots from the southeast, which would have been a little bit of a downwind kind of, you know, with the wind at my back and side. But it wound up being a straight east wind, which was on my right side. And it was probably about, I would say, 8 knots to 10 knots in the morning. And as you know, like, usually as the day goes on, it gets windier. So I remember I saw white caps already right when we started, and all this side chop and a lot of wind. And I remember looking at my boyfriend who was on the boat. He got me into paddling, and he kind of knew what I was thinking, like, oh boy, this is going to be a long paddle. And it was. The wind never let up. It was always to the right side. I had swell come in from my right side. I had wind coming from my right side, and the current was coming from my left side. So I was pretty much paddling on my left side for 90% of the time. We only had one storm that came through, and that was at night. It lasted for about 2 hours, and it just kicked up the wind, but there was no lightning or any rain, so that was kind of a good thing. It was just really hard to see. The moon went away, and it was really, really choppy. It was probably about 4 feet.
You're listening to a previous conversation that we had with Victoria Burgess, a fire inspector with the Pompano Beach Fire Department. Recently, she paddleboarded from Havana to Key West, the first woman to do it. That's about 115 miles, and she did it in just under 28 hours. Now, she sent that in to the Guinness Book of World Records, and she's waiting to hear back from them. But regardless, the city of Pompano Beach has recognized one day of the year as Victoria Burgess Day. Let's return to that conversation. I'd imagine throughout this journey, there's got to be some interesting stuff to see, but you were really focused, you know? So, I mean, there probably were all sorts of things swimming around you, but you had to be really focused on what you were doing because, again, of the conditions. But, I mean, really? You didn't stop to look around?
No, I tried, but even, you know, on my way before we could still see land, and I wanted to try to just turn my head to see the land, but it was so choppy and windy, I didn't want to, you know, ruin any energy trying to, you know, get back on my board or whatever. So I just said, hey, can you see land anymore? And it wound up being a game like that. They kind of told me, and it was funny because I actually reviewed the footage that the videographer took, and my eyes are just, and you can see it at night especially, my eyes are like wide open. I think one time with the night vision, I maybe blinked twice in this one part. It was just, it's just crazy how focused I was. I was constantly looking at the nose of my board and making sure I had it in the right spot in the water so I can keep my board straight and not get pushed around. If you get taken away by the wind or the current or the waves, you know, it's sometimes it just takes a lot more energy to get back on track. So my focus was basically just keeping myself on track to make it as easy as possible for my body, not have to fight anything.
So this has been filmed. Is any of that ever going to be, you know, released to the public? Will we ever get to see your journey?
Yeah, we're making a full-length documentary. I'm not sure how long it's going to take. Probably, I would assume a few months. I don't really have too much video production skills, so someone else is handling that.
So throughout the process, you're nonstop trying to get to Key West. How do you get rest? How do you eat? And of course, the question a lot of people probably asked you. I mean, you have to do your humanly duties. How do you stop and go to the bathroom?
So I had a very specific plan for eating nutritionally. I made sure no matter if I was hungry or not that I ate every hour, either a sandwich or pasta, or I had a little menu for myself, a couple different kinds of sandwiches, pasta Alfredo. And then every half hour or so, and more as we went on, I had snacks. I had like cookies and bananas, quick sugar type of things that kept me pepped up. So I was pretty much constantly eating. Every hour I went over to the boat, they handed me my food, and if it wasn't too rough, I sat down for like a minute or so. My board was kind of bashing into the side of the boat whenever I tried to do that because of the waves, so I had to limit it to only a couple minutes. And I would just use that time to like chew my food and stretch my legs. I think it really helped in the long run. And then as far as it goes with using the bathroom, Luckily, I was expending a lot of energy, so that didn't happen too often. But yeah, I had to go in the water once. And then, like, the rest of the stuff, I either just, like, I don't know, I was just standing up peeing, basically, when I was paddling. Kind of gross.
Did you ever get tired? Did you ever feel like you're not going to make it?
I never got tired. I never got tired. Yeah, it was really weird. My body was, I feel like my nutrition was so on point. There was one point where my mind started just wanting to stop, and I had a little more sugar. I drank some Coke, ate some more cookies, and it kind of pepped me up. But it was really cool to see how the food I was eating was affecting my mood. And I did a lot of practice with learning how to relax my muscles while I was paddling and how to switch on different muscle groups when certain ones got tired. And I don't know if that makes sense, but it really worked out well. I was able to paddle and still relax at the same time. The only time I really, really got tired was probably the last mile or two. I tried to sprint. That didn't work out too well. And then the heat started getting to me, and I stopped eating because I was excited to get there, and I just started bonking, but I made it.
What was it like in the final stretch, all the way up to the very end when you get there? Take me to that moment.
I want to say maybe a quarter mile before the boat had an anchor and my three crew members got off. We had extra boards for them, and they got on the boards with me so they can paddle in with me. So that was just a really cool thing, just in general, being out there in the last part with those guys and having them come in with me. And then we had a lot of friends and family that were on the beach. My parents were there, and then a bunch of our friends came down from Fort Lauderdale, and we have a bunch of Key West friends that were there, and they were blowing conch shells and ringing bells and horns. And so it was really cool. And, you know, I got off my board and I still could stand. I was using my paddle to kind of help me a little bit, but my adrenaline kicked in again. And yeah, you know, I kind of was a little hazy at that moment. I didn't have any emotional breakdown or anything like that. I was just happy to be there, and it was kind of like a bit of a blur.
So, I mean, after such an amazing accomplishment, how do you top that? What's your next journey that you're planning?
Well, I have a couple of things in mind. One of them is a 2-year goal, so it's going to take a while. And it's something that it doesn't have anything to do with the water. First, I plan on surfing bigger waves. That's just a short-term goal. But as far as any crossings go, I don't know of one yet that I want to do. Maybe if something comes up that interests me, I will. But the goal for right now is, on the side, I do a lot of rock climbing. And a friend of mine who had been trying to summit Everest for a while is going again in 2021. I've been climbing with him a lot on my just side time. And I was talking to him before I left, telling him I might be interested one day. And he asked me yesterday, actually, if I wanted to train for that for 2021 with him. So I kind of think that's going to be my next focus.
And again, that was Victoria Burgess, fire inspector for the Pompano Beach Fire Department. I don't know about you, but listening to that, I'm inspired. Not to do that, but just inspired. And I wish her the best of luck if she's going to be climbing Everest. Again, she paddleboarded from Havana, Cuba to Key West, Florida in under 28 hours. You can read more about her story and see photos at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, have you seen that truck, the black container truck called the BuzzBox? We're going to introduce you to the man who helped create it and what he's doing with it. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. All right, so imagine yourself right now at a barbershop. Get a nice little cut. Take a little off the side for me right there, please. Thank you. Where you are not only getting a haircut, but a life lesson. Imagine that. There's a barbershop traveling around South Florida on wheels doing just that. The clear see-through container has made stops around Miami-Dade and Broward County, giving underprivileged youth free haircuts, mentorship, and a rundown on how to stay safe around railroad tracks. That's the message now. This is part of a recent partnership with Brightline and the nonprofit Buzz It Forward. Children must participate in a quick tutorial on rail safety and take a rail safety pledge before stepping into the BuzzBox barbershop. Joining us now in studio is Andrew Ragnanen. He is a local barber who's been using haircuts for years as a tool to educate, connect, and inspire children. And he is the head barber and mentor of the Buzz It Forward program, and he's here to discuss new expansion of the program. Andrew, such a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know what? Real quickly, I mean, how do you describe, and I've actually, somebody in our newsroom said, hey, I saw the BuzzBox in my neighborhood, but how do you describe it to people?
I don't think my words ever really do the BuzzBox justice. No matter how, you know, you try to describe it, and then when people see it and they experience it, they're just in utter. I always get the feedback, this is not what I expected. This is amazing. People love it. We've gotten nothing but positive feedback everywhere we go, Dade County, Broward County, as far as Palm Beach County, thanks to our partnership with Brightline.
Now, where did the idea come from?
Well, the idea started when I retired from the military. I wanted to be able to give back in some form or fashion, and I had a talent and skill as a barber. And so what I started doing was just giving haircuts for grades. You know, my young clients have said, hey, look, if you make the honor roll, buddy, I'll give you a free haircut. You know, you save your mom some money, then you can use that money to take your mom out to dinner, do something nice for her, right? And so it kind of caught on, and I realized kids were paying attention. I was pumping gas one day, getting ready to go into Key Largo, and these three young kids come out of the gas station. They're like, hey, you're the guy you said if I made the honor roll, I get a free haircut, right? And that's when I realized they were really listening.
Now, this is fascinating because you had actually, yes, you started working with youth. You were talking to some kids, and you just made this promise. Bring me your grades. Let me see how you're doing, and you get a free haircut. And that just really blew up.
And, yes, that grew into what we have now. I met Amir and Mike, who are partners with the BuzzBox and Talent for Change, and they had some of the same initiative where they were trying to give back. And we grew into what we're doing now.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, I think about the barber, such an important person in my life, because that's the guy I'm going to sit, I'm going to talk to him. I don't even think about it. I just start talking about my personal life, what's going on with the family, what's going on with the job. That's the role of the barber. It's like you're like a psychologist in a way. You start talking to these kids, and they're telling you all kinds of fascinating stories.
That's true. And from my experience, the best thing that I can do as a barber when I'm speaking to a kid is to not be judgmental, to have some empathy and some compassion, and try to be as understanding as I can, and offer some words of advice and wisdom. Ultimately, we don't want kids at 14 and 15 years old making a decision that can adversely affect them for the rest of their life, because sometimes they just don't know that these adverse effects are going to follow them, and that comes into the mentoring.
Did you think about being a mentor, or you were just listening to them?
No, I thought I was just honestly just listening and trying to help them, you know, make some good decisions and stay on the right path, because it's so easy to get drawn into something negative. And we just try to incentivize them demonstrating the appropriate behavior by offering, you know, a free haircut. You know, if you just do what you're supposed to do, we'll recognize that, because it's easy for you to not, you know, demonstrate the appropriate behavior. And there's always punishment for that. But we want to recognize you for doing what's right, and just being, you know, a good kid that's doing what you're supposed to do.
Now, you just mentioned another name, and this is the person who's helped you with the BuzzBox. Amir?
Yes.
Who is this?
Amir Youssef. He used to own Chop Shop Barbershop in Wynwood, and I met him. It had nothing to do with barbering. He had a spoken word event at his shop. One of my clients was performing and invited me, and I showed up, and Amir and I had a conversation, and he was having an event called the Buzzathon, and what we were doing there was local barbers came together, and we were providing haircuts throughout the whole day. The adults received the haircuts that they paid for, and then they had the opportunity to sponsor the haircut for a child, and that's why the program is called, you know, Buzz It Forward. Instead of paying it forward, you're buzzing it forward with haircuts. So the adult pays for the haircut, and the child then receives the haircut the adult paid for.
How did Brightline get into this whole setup now?
Well, Brightline was looking for a unique way to engage youth and also the members of the homeless community. Both communities, which Talent for Change and the Buzz Box, we had already engaged. So it just seemed like, you know, a very symbiotic relationship for Brightline and, you know, Buzz Box to work together.
Because now these kids, they come in, you're driving the Buzz Box around, and the kids can come in and they can get the free haircut. Now it's not about the grades, though. Now it's about, they've got to understand rail safety, because this is part of what Brightline's trying to do now in their campaign, which is teach rail safety. But so how does that work? The kid comes in, then what?
Well, correct. Well, what happens is the kids sign up, you know, for their haircut, and part of their process is they're taking a rail safety pledge. So we have these rail safety pledges from Brightline, and the children, we read over the safety pledge and we explain, you know, why this is important, and we generally want you to be safe. We don't want anything adverse happening. And so that's the prerequisite, and they do that, and they come in and they receive the haircut. And while they're receiving the haircut, we continue to have that dialogue about being safe and, you know, encouraging your friends also who may not be here today receiving this haircut, but you signed a safety pledge and you take it with you, and encourage your friends to be safe around the train tracks as well, because we're probably not going to be able to reach every child, but if we can reach you and then you communicate that to your friends and encourage them to be safe instead of daring your buddy to run across the track, you know, we want you to take the positive course of action.
I'm speaking with Andrew Ragnanen about Buzz It Forward, a unique program that mentors underprivileged kids and provides free haircuts. And you could see the Buzz Box, the mobile haircutting container around Miami-Dade. And there are pictures, by the way, on our website, WLRN.org. You know, for you, you know, this, again, as you said, this goes back after you left the military. You had already done work as a barber, or what? You know, I want to get a sense of why, how'd you end up in this field?
Well, I started cutting hair when I was 16. I never considered it work. It was just something that I liked to do, and it was fun. I had never charged anybody for a haircut from 16 to 40. Whenever I deployed, I always took my tools with me, and my battle buddies were in Iraq and Afghanistan, Kuwait. You know, we still have to maintain that military appearance, and some people didn't feel comfortable going to local barbers in those countries. So I would just provide haircuts, and never charging anyone. For me, you know, being able to provide a service at no cost to a child or someone that's in a homeless community, it doesn't adversely affect me at all. And I just feel like I'm doing something that they appreciate. And sometimes people just need a little bit of help and encouragement. And I think that's what we do.
And one of the things now that you're doing is you're also providing haircuts for the homeless.
Correct. Because that's also a community that, you know, Brightline is very interested in engaging. So we travel. The partnership with Brightline has really allowed the Buzz Box to stretch. Like I said, we travel from Dade County, Broward County, all the way to Palm Beach County. And we work with shelters up there also, as far as haircuts and services for males and females that are in the shelter.
All right. So right now it's just one Buzz Box, right?
One Buzz Box.
What's the plan? What do you think? Do you see lots of Buzz Boxes maybe driving around South Florida?
Well, the intent is to have more than one Buzz Box in these different communities so that the local barbers in these communities can support the people in their community. You know, the barbershop is a pillar of any community. You very rarely do you find a community without a barbershop. So I think ideally we would like to have a Buzz Box in each community so that those local barbers can invest in the people in their communities instead of, you know, us traveling up and down. That's not as effective and as efficient as having, you know, the Buzz Box in your local community and your barbers supporting your people.
Let's see, you said it too. You talked about how that the barbershop is a pillar of a community, and I think about how important my barber is to me. So, I mean, why is that? Why do you think the barbershop is so important?
Well, I think the barbershop is important because everybody gets a haircut. Everybody comes to the barbershop. The lawyer, the doctor, the dentist, the sanitation worker, the football player, the basketball player, you know, the tech guy, everybody comes to the barbershop, and you don't really know who these people are. So as a barber, you're almost like a connector. Someone may need a doctor or a mechanic, and you're my client, you come in and we're just having a conversation, and you express during this course of conversation you have this need, but you're not really sure how you're going to meet that need. And I said, hey, you know, I have a client that does XYZ. I'll give him a call and let him know, you know, what you need, and I'll see, you know, and then I'll just connect you. And then at that point, you know, your need is met, maybe your problem is being resolved, and then I can just step back. And that's part of my role as a barber.
Is there a way to know where the buzz box is going next?
Absolutely. You can go to our website, talent4change.org, and we have a calendar on the website, and you can follow the buzz box. And anytime you see the buzz box set up in any local event, please know that children can sign up and receive the free haircut in exchange for their rail safety pledge sponsored by Brightline.
He is Andrew Ragnanen. He is with Buzz It Forward, again, this unique program mentoring underprivileged children. And you can see that buzz box. Again, go to our website, WLRN.org. As he said, you could also, we'll have a link to that website so you can see where it's going. And it's all part of this program with Brightline and teaching kids rail safety. Haircuts and rail safety, a good mix. Andrew, thanks so much, man. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
And that's the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.